Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Feiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of The Middle Ground.
Actually, it is not Michael Charney that's co-hosting with me. Annabelle Park is joining me. We are in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm Eric Feiler, and welcome to The Middle Ground. I'm very excited to introduce you to our guest. His name is Reverend Dr. William Barber II, and he is, to many people in North Carolina, especially some of the old-timers, he is looked upon as something like an, I guess you could say, an inheritor of the civil rights movement that many of the old timers around here carried on their backs. They're very excited about the fusion movement, and by that we mean interracial, intercultural, across faiths, across economic class, that is challenging the North Carolina state government, which many of you know was elected with the help of a very wealthy sort of Koch brothers type of guy. His name is Art Pope. And it is now implementing a set of policies that are very much in line with, I think, the kind of America that invests in its profiteers rather than investing in its people. So without giving you any more about my assessment on it, I just want to bring in Reverend Dr. William Barber II and ask him, his son is the third, and ask him to say hello and tell us a little bit about what we witnessed and what you may have heard about taking place yesterday. Reverend Dr. Barber, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, Eric, thank you so much, and thanks also to all of your listeners who are here. Is that, and I think Annabelle is on as well, so thank you, Annabelle, for being here tonight. We are indeed in a very pivotal moment in North Carolina, but this battle in North Carolina really has national implications, because the most egregious actions and public policies that are affecting the foundation of our democracy are coming out of state houses. You know, 38 state houses, state general assemblies, have taken under efforts to engage in voter suppression through what we call modern-day poll taxes, which is voter ID. And that's just one example. And I think that, as you mentioned, oftentimes we don't pay attention to that, particularly in the South. But the reality is, as I did an interview with you all and you published it on the Third Reconstruction, the South really drives the rest of the nation, whether you look at how it turned the nation in the 1800s, how it turned the nation in the 1960s, and certainly today, with all of the new changes, new demographics, new facts coming out, we are at a critical moment. And that moment is whether we will go forward with this broad-based fusion politics and very and public policy that lifts the poor rather than destroys the poor, or whether or not we will go backwards into kind of an old South quarantine-type public policy that is only concerned about a certain color, a certain kind, and people who have certain wealth. That's really the choice that's before us now. And I think people in North Carolina are saying we want to go, our movement is forward together movement, the forward together, not one step back movement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to let Annabelle ask you the next question. Annabelle, thanks very much for replacing Michael today.
Hey, sure, no problem. I'm very excited to talk to you, Reverend Barber. I have so many questions for you, as you can imagine.
And Eric called me and said the old timers. I'm going to talk to him about that, talking about old timers. But we'll get at that later. Yes.
I think he got that from Al.
Yeah, I know. Okay.
My question is really a strategic question about where this is headed, given that there is a supermajority in both houses and the governor's house, and it's incredibly exciting to see the movement growing. We've been documenting this, and I was thrilled yesterday to see the turnout and the level of passion and enthusiasm and joy. But I'm just wondering, given the way it's shaped right now in terms of the legal options, like what do you see going forward in terms of the strategy? How do we win?
Well, I think we first have to do an analysis in here in North Carolina is that why we're being attacked. Mm-hmm. We're being attacked because we already had a movement. 6 years in the building, started with the NAACP's 100 branches and 16 other organizations. There's now 100 NAACP local branches, youth and college and adults, and 147 coalition partners. You know, just this past February, we had nearly 20,000 people in front of the legislature. We brought 500 activists to the halls of the legislature. We've got branches and local assemblies all over the state of North Carolina, and we have won over the last few years some of the most progressive public policy in the nation. Same-day registration, early voting, that was a result of our coalition. Sunday voting, result of our coalition. Racial Justice Act, nowhere else in the country except Kentucky, part of our coalition. One of the first states, the only state in the South to raise the minimum wage before the federal did, because of that coalition. And I could go on and on and on down the line of significant pieces. So first of all, we have to understand that the attack we see happening against the Tea Party conservative, ultra-conservative side of the political landscape is because of our strength, is because of our victories. It is because they were able to get away with gerrymandering the voting districts last time and really rigging the election. Now, having said that, Annabelle, they have a supermajority.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't just put one thing about Southern folk, you can't just push us around anyway, any kind of way. And while they have a supermajority, the Constitution is still firm. And this body, even last year, passed bills in the legislature that the courts overturned, not federal courts, state courts.
Right.
So we have great hope in our ability to fight them on legal fronts, particularly some of the things they're trying to do with voting and with unemployment and those areas. But also, the notion in the movement, you may have the votes, but we have another election in 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
There are 4 million voters in North Carolina, and we don't believe all of those voters, majority, are ultra-conservative. We have 23% of the electorate is African-American now. You add 4% Latino. That means 27% of the electorate is now people of color. That's more than half of 51%.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
We
have a movement going on. We have 10 million citizens in North Carolina. And what's interesting to me, even many of the newspapers are beginning, after we've begun this civil disobedience and challenging them, we didn't just come to that easily. But even newspapers and editorial boards are saying these policies, and I'll outline some of them to your audience when you ask me, are just way overreach. It takes us backwards rather than forward.
Mm-hmm.
And North Carolinians, even white North Carolinians, many of them, while they may not agree with NAACP and everything, the one thing they don't want to do is go backwards into fights and battles that we've already fought in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Eric and I have been spending a lot of time interviewing conservatives, and they do use this expression over and over again. They do want to go back. We've had interesting results asking them, what do you want to go back to? What period of time was optimal for you, in your opinion? And what's so interesting, Reverend Barber, is that they seem to say whatever decade was their childhood.
the 40s, 50s.
And one person, she's the head of the Eastern North Carolina Tea Party, Diane, what's her name?
Rufino.
Yeah, she said she wanted to go back to the 60s. People didn't get pregnant in the 60s.
But isn't that the point? There's so much of their rhetoric and their politics is based on distortion and false information and not empirical data, which is, in fact, I believe, the great trick of many wealthy, not all wealthy, but many wealthy people who have decided that if they can get a base to vote candidates that they want in office, candidates they fund, then they can sell that base, this red meat, this racially driven politics, you know, this we're going to save you, we're going to, you know, we're going to protect you. And then once they get in office, what do? They primarily get those candidates to filter money to them through tax breaks to the wealthy. You know, yesterday I call it bait and switch. You know, they and it's always been the case. They play the race card, they play the division card, and get grassroots everyday working white people to vote for them, and then they never deliver on the social issues, not in reality. But they make sure they get paid, and that's what we're seeing right now. Give you one example. You know, they stirred up the Tea Party, the conservatives, over voter ID and anti-Obama and anti, you know, affordable health care, and they won the election here in this state, you know, got them a supermajority. Now, what have this group primarily been doing? Say, Berger, he floats a tax plan, and that tax plan will give millionaires a $56,000 tax break. But the average working person will now have to pay taxes on their haircuts, their hairdos, prescription drugs, food. And the average person that doesn't even agree with the NAACP, who happens to be white, doesn't even know this. And then when we point it out, they say, what? Yeah, the people you voted for that said they were going to protect you are actually now robbing you. Or the people you voted for who said they weren't going to raise taxes, and you voted for them because you think that raising taxes means paying for entitlements that are going to go to black and brown people who don't deserve it. So you voted for them. Now, the very people that told you they weren't going to raise taxes aren't going to raise them on the super wealthy, but they are going to raise it on you, and you are working, happen to be working and white and poor.
Well, I want to ask you something. I want to ask you about kind of the psychology of the politics, because you know, I feel like, I mean, the reason I brought up this point about people wanting to go back to whatever decade where they were children, I mean, I guess what I've noticed is there's a lot of brilliant marketing going on, you know, by the conservatives, the extreme right-wing conservatives. And I feel like they're using very psychological tactics, like they want to kind of appeal to people's sense of nostalgia and a sense of comfort and security that they had, I don't know, when they were growing up, and not really getting people to understand that how our economy has shifted and how much actually has changed. And I think it's so difficult for people trying to deal with the new realities to explain the complexity of what is going on, you know, and marketing the truth is always difficult. And this is one reason why I'm so impressed with what you're doing in North Carolina, is that I can't actually think of anyone better. I mean, you're really incredible at explaining the truth in a way that, like, has that emotional resonance, you know? Go ahead.
Well, I think, let me see, it's more sinister, a little bit more sinister even than what you see. Who's funding the market? Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch. Who was their daddy, Freddie Koch? What did he do? He funded the Birch Society. The Birch Society, you know, were wealthy, and they were against all the things like Brown versus Board of Education, the NAACP, and whatnot. Then you got Art Pope. Now, Art Pope in our state spent $40 million. Why would Art Pope be interested in controlling government? It's got to be some way beneficial to him. As a person, because that's what he's interested in, wealth. But these wealthy people like the Koch brothers and Pope know that fear sells, and fear will motivate people's political. Fear or hope is what motivates people's political activity. So they sell, you know, working class white people fear, and they make them afraid of black people, afraid of brown people. They make them afraid of the country, that the country is broke because of entitlement. Everybody know the country is broke because of all the wars we've been in, and nothing, you know, and all of the tax that where wealthy do not pay their fair share. But they sell them this, and it's not a hard sale because of the racialized history of America, because of how right around the 1960s, with the same entitlements that helped uplift white America in the 1960s, when black and brown people began to have access to them, all of a sudden those entitlements became a negative thing. And you have to understand that racial narrative that has been connected to it. But these guys stood up and said, if we can sell these folk fear, then we can run candidates who will promise to calm their fears by doing this, 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 and this in the social arena. But we'll whisper in the back room to those candidates, whether or not you can deliver on that, just keep the rhetoric going, but make sure you deliver on tax cuts to the wealthy. Make sure you privatize government so that then we can invest in those very agencies that you privatize and make more money. Now, I think it's just that sinister, you know, and I think many people are starting to see that. And so what we have to do, you're exactly right, Annabelle, is expose. And for instance, in the first 50 days of this legislature, they said they're going to deny 500,000 people Medicaid. Now, I've seen many of my working class white friends said, that's right, they're denying that Medicaid to folk that don't need it. And what we've got to do is show them, wait a minute, open your eyes. They didn't say 500,000 black people. They didn't say 500,000 Latino people. These are 500,000 North Carolinians. Some of them are Republicans. Some of them are Democrats. Some of them are your cousins. Some of them are your family members that are going to be denied fundamental health care. You see what I'm saying? To 165,000 unemployed people, we have to say, wait a minute. I know the racial narrative is black people are unemployed and lazy and don't want to work. Brown people, but back up and understand that 9% of North Carolinians, many of them are white, and you, your brothers, sisters, and your friends will be impacted by this. So we have to slowly slow down and unpack it to show that they've elected people based on fear and who promised to protect them, but actually the policies that they're implementing are going to do everything but protect them. It's actually going to devastate them. Hello?
Oh, sorry about that, Reverend Barber. I was talking, but I was muted. I wanted to do a little bit of history homework. First, in recent history, the past three Mondays, you and a coalition, a very broad coalition of concerned citizens, have visited the General Assembly in Raleigh, North Carolina, and an increasing number of people have been arrested each week, and now the total is somewhere near 100.
But, 101, actually.
Okay, it's 101. And so people can read about in the papers, and I don't want to go into too much detail about the incredible sights, I mean, incredible actions that Annabelle and I have witnessed and documented. And for those of you who don't know, we're uploading videos at our website, storyofamerica.org. In a few hours, we'll have one that was shot yesterday. But I wanted to go deeper into history before we go to the phones, and let me give out the number, 646-929-2495. If you want to speak to Reverend Barber, 646-929-2495. When we first met you, the very first time we met you, we interviewed you and we talked about history in a much broader context, going back 150 years to the end of the Civil War. And I wanted to try to draw an analogy. What you just described, in which basically stereotypes and assumptions about people who are different were used by marketeers to sell people fear. In recent years, that's been true. And it was also true at a time in our history, another time when we were attempting to make government work for all of the people, including African Americans, and you called it fusion politics during the Reconstruction era. And I wonder if there's an analogy in terms of the type of marketing that was done to replace fusion politics with white supremacy all those years ago.
It directly, because what happened was in 1868, you have in North Carolina, for instance, a rewriting of the Constitution. Blacks and whites engage in it. They lift up all of this positive public policy, voting rights, labor rights, educational rights, new tax policies, and even labor rights. And inside of 4 years, you have a market campaign. In fact, the head of the market campaign in North Carolina was a guy later on elected governor, Charles B. Aycox, and he was the orator, and he began in the late 1800s to go around the state just before the Wilmington Rise of 1898. He helped set up the Wilmington Rise with his oratory. He would go around. He was a fiery speaker, and his argument—he was, you know, fairly well off—and his argument was that if you don't stop fusion politics of blacks and whites, then the white daughters are going to be in trouble, and they're going to come into your house, and they're going to hurt your children's future. You know, even when he said, if you don't help us get in office, all of the black people will be more educated than you will. Your own sons will be educated. In fact, he did a speech in 1896 in the county I'm in a little place called Eureka. There was 1,000 white men there, and when he finished speaking, they were foaming at the mouth, literally foaming at mm-hmm. the mouth. It was 2 years before the Wilmington Rise. Now, mm-hmm. the wealthiest, one of the wealthiest people in the state was a guy by the name of, was the owner of the News and Observer. And later on, he became Secretary of the Navy. He was appointed Secretary of the Navy. McCall is his name. And he used his paper, and in the paper, they would put cartoons, and the cartoons would look like this. Would have a big black man with black lips and looking like a vampire and a little white girl in the corner, and it would be like he was about to grab him, and it would say, this is what's happening to our government. This is what's happening. Mm-hmm. But again, Hugh McCall and his brother, Joe McCall, they were very wealthy, and they stood to benefit immensely if the government changed and their friends were in power and government contracts could be directed to their businesses. You see, that's one of the things we never really examine in this. How many, government is a major business. And if Wall Street is shutting down and businesses are not expanding, then where do you build more wealth? You privatize education, and then you invest in it. You privatize prison, then you invest in it. You privatize mental health service, and you invest in it. You see what I'm saying? And so, but in order to do that, I've got to get control. And then I get control, and then I end up circulating the government contracts and all that right back into my businesses. Somebody ought to do one day a check on how many government contracts, for instance, does Halliburton have? You know, the very people that you know, Dick Cheney, for instance, cut taxes. But I bet you if you searched it out, Halliburton gets a significant amount of its income through government contracts. So on the one hand, folks are saying cut taxes, but on the back end, they're actually using the government through military contracts and contracts and everything else to make wealth. It's slick. It is very slick. And it requires a marketing that has a deep disrespect. It requires a marketing that basically says that working class white people are gullible. And all you got to do is feed them fear. And they'll vote without doing the deeper analysis. And when the truth of the matter is, working class white people and working class black people and Latinos and poor whites and all are about in the same position. In fact, there are more poor whites in this country than there are blacks.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think that you know, Annabelle and I in the film Story of America, we're really trying to explore a narrative that can include poor whites, those whites who we commonly say vote against their own interests. And the reason why I think so many of them want to secede from the union, or they're so angry when the election goes against their way that they'd rather see the country fail than succeed under a Bill Clinton or a Barack Obama, it's in many ways because the narrative posits them as the bad guy, whether during the Civil War or during the Civil Rights Movement, and they don't want to be the bad guy in the national narrative of their country. And so I was just thinking that instead of allowing the choice to be either racist or gullible or whatever, if we say, look, poor whites have power in this country. They have tremendous power. They had power at the dawn of the Jim Crow era. They have power today. And the way to seize that power is to recognize that they're being marketed to. Because after all, I've seen that vampire cartoon as well. Jim Crow and the white supremacy South was not inevitable. That was marketed. That was generated through newspapers and orators, because if whites and blacks had worked together to self-govern, as was happening in the 1860s after the Civil War during the Reconstruction era, if they had worked together, then the ruling class would no longer be able to extract wealth from the government in order to profiteer from the government and from the basically the livelihoods of people by owning the things that they need in order to survive. So, you know, one of the diatribe here, but one of the things that I've stumbled upon is that, you know, these white Southerners, we talk to people who do the Civil War reenactments, and they don't like being the bad guys of the Civil War. And so many of them will say, and I think they have a good point here, is that my ancestors didn't own slaves. My ancestors were too poor to own slaves. So don't blame me for slavery, and don't blame me for going to war to defend my community, my state, my country, many of them saw. And I think by the same token, I think we can say that we do not blame the soldiers who fought in Iraq for the travesty of the Iraq War. It was oil barons and it was war profiteers who wanted that war. They marketed it well, and our boys, our soldiers, our men and women went to war. And it's no more the fault of those soldiers for fighting for war profiteering and oil in Iraq than, well, let me just posit that to you, than it is the fault of those people who have Confederate ancestors or their ancestors for going to war essentially to defend a very lucrative labor model, which was slavery.
Well, people, right, you have to remember the fundamental piece of slavery was about economics. I mean, but then in order to justify the system of slavery economics, you had to have what I call, bad biology. You had to argue that, you know, biologically and by nature, people were meant to be slaves. You had to have a sick sociology that suggested that people ought not be together because of the color of their skin. And then you had to have what we call a heretical ontology, and that is to suggest that God ordained it to be that way. And if you put those three things in place, then you can come up with an evil economic, and that is the whole system of slavery. So racism, you know, is quite complex, and you've got to engage, and slavery was quite complex. You got to engage in extreme contortions, mentally, psychologically, constitutionally, in order to embrace it. Now, I wouldn't go so far to say that it's exactly like the Iraq piece, and nor would I go so far to say that people can say, well, my ancestors didn't, because as Tim Wise says in his book, whether you participated in slavery actively or not, we have to still deal with the reality of white privilege. There are certain things, you know, when people say, well, your family ought to just pull up their bootstraps and run from now. Yeah, but your family got a 40-yard head start by just white privilege. You know, there were things that people's grandparents could invest in because of the system of Jim Crow that my parents couldn't. For instance, my parents in the 1960s, my father had two master's degrees and an undergraduate degree in physics. My mother had a business degree. But in the South, with all of that, they still didn't have protected voting rights. There were places when people got FHA loans years ago that you could not get an FHA loan as an African-American if you for a long time. And then when you could get one, you could only borrow on certain sides of town, which affected the family's equity. So, you know, this is back up. My grandmother, who was worked on the farm, was not able to even pay into Social Security until 1954. Because when President Roosevelt first passed the law, he had to cut a deal with Southern. Now, they weren't slaveholders either. But those same Southern senators said, we will only agree with the New Deal, only agree with parts of Social Security, if you can guarantee that people in the agrarian culture and domestics can't pay in. Well, who were in the agrarian culture and domestics? That was black sharecroppers and black maids. You see what I'm saying? So it's the way in which racism has forced us in this country to go through all of these various contortions is mind-boggling. You know, that's why I tell people racism is not just a political opinion or a sociological piece. Racism is to some degree a religion. It is because it becomes the pivotal value upon which all other decisions are made. That's why we talk about systemic racism, not just somebody calling you the N-word, but the way in which systems, you know, have been established, you know. And so, but having said that, I agree with you. And that's why the HKOJ People's Coalition movement is so powerful in North Carolina, because it is attracting whites, it is attracting blacks, it is attracting Latinos, it is attracting young people. And we're able to forge an agenda. We have a 14-point agenda that where people can look at it and find themselves and understand how much we need to be in fusion today, and they unpack, you know, notice the crowds that you have seen. They unpack these effects about what's really going on in public power. Notice what you've seen the last 3 weeks. You've seen large number of white people, poor white, black, you know, black, poor blacks, middle-aged doctors, all standing side by side saying that, listen, this is the wrong direction for North Carolina, cutting 500,000 people out of Medicaid in a state that has 1.6 million poor people, 600,000 children. You know, cutting unemployment when 9% of North Carolinians are unemployed and 15% of minorities are unemployed, it's just wrong. You know, raising taxes on poor working people, wrong. Trying to finagle with the voting rights in a way that will hurt poor people, will hurt poor senior citizens and homeless people and poor whites and students. You know, we're in a time, thank God for internet, thank God for us coming together, thanks for us having a movement, where we're able to break through that marketing. And that's part of what we're doing with civil disobedience. We're saying we're going to break through the marketing. You may control, you know, supermajority. You can almost control the media unless we do something radical in a way that forces the media to report what's really going on. And what has been amazing to us is the way in which the media has not just been reporting on acts of civil disobedience. We're not just some anarchists that want to tear down the world, but because we didn't just come to civil disobedience, Eric, simply, you know, we wrote the governor a powerful letter in December, said, if you work on economic sustainability, addressing poverty, labor rights, education equality, health care, dealing with disparity in the criminal justice system, and voting rights, we'll work with you, Republican or not. He dismissed it. We brought nearly 20,000 people to the General Assembly. They dismissed it. Hundreds of activists came as lobbyists. They dismissed it. There's a picture of the Speaker of the House running down the back steps rather than talking to the people. So they have actually set this up now so that when we go to civil disobedience, the media says, wait a minute, these folks didn't just start getting arrested. What? Why are they getting arrested? And then the why forces a different question, and that forces the media to report on issues that otherwise might not be highlighted.
It is really a brilliant strategy. I have to say that this is on the verge, from what I witnessed yesterday, it's on the verge of becoming like Madison, Wisconsin, and I think that may be why they arrest you so quickly when you enter the building. They give you 5 minutes and they start arresting people.
Yeah, and it may even become, you know, it may become Birmingham. It's 50 years later, because remember, 50 years ago, we were in the middle of Birmingham, and what did they tell Dr. King? Birmingham was the steel city. It would never be broken. Bull Connor was there. You know, they had tanks. But the Birmingham campaign was the campaign that gave hope all across the country. Now, it happened in 63. Mega got killed June 12, 63, but the March on Washington also took place in 63, and people forget that in July you had that major gathering in Detroit. 100,000 people turned out in Detroit, I think, in July of 63. Of course, you did have the bombing of the Birmingham church and four little girls killed, but actually the killing of those girls brought a lot of people into the movement who weren't in it, because they said, wait a minute now. We may have some disagreement with Dr. King and NAACP, but killing babies in Sunday school, oh no, this is not the America we want. You know, by the end of the year, there was certainly the assassination of President Kennedy. But even in some ways, you know, that forced us to say we have to deal with this issue of racism and discrimination. So, you know, I don't know where we will go, but I tell you, you know, the start was 17, then the 30, and then 49, and then the 5 students. But more important, the energy, the diversity, the people that were out there, you know, from 83 years old to 19 years old, black, white, and even Annabelle and Eric, that's why some people are struggling trying to understand, because, you know, the first day we went, and I don't know who it was, but we went to the General Assembly, and I have very good ears, I guess, because I can't turn my neck that well because of a condition I have, so I hear things. And we walked in, and I heard a legislator, I don't know who he was, say, I thought the NAACP was coming. What are all these white folk doing with them? And I laughed, you know, because I said, you don't get it. people, uh-huh. This is about fusion. This is about the good of the whole. You will not be able to pigeonhole this movement in your normal way.
Mm-hmm.
No,
I mean, I think that's what's really powerful about it is that it is genuinely diverse. And I think people are incredibly inspired by seeing one another show up. And,
mm-hmm.
and I think for so long, you know, people just feel so alone in their own complaints about the government. But suddenly, there are all these people. They're, you know, they're your family. And it feels joyful, you know. And, and it's really incredibly exciting.
Yeah.
Do you have
hope
a few more minutes?
Okay. Yeah, okay. Sure, I can stay on.
Yeah, I just have another question. You know, I'm really trying to understand, and this is partly because, you know, I'm Asian American, and
mm-hmm.
I actually grew up in the South. First in South Korea, I was in South Korea, and then I was in Texas. And I feel like, you know, in some ways, I mean, I am a Southerner in many ways. But, I mean, because I'm Asian-American, like, I never really quite understood the racial divide until I started to really study things like the civil rights movement. But
mm-hmm.
I'm kind of right now really trying to struggle with this. How do we get past some of the racial divide so that we can make more, not just, you know, economic progress, but just more progress? How do we bring it to that level where people understand that this is a moral issue? And I love the fact that you're calling the event Moral Monday.
Moral Monday, right.
But I feel like it's really hard to puncture that part of the brain that get people to understand that this is about what's right and wrong and not about black, white, or any other thing. But this really is about what's right and wrong. And trying to get to that part of the brain that gets them to see that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's kind of what I'm trying to do all the time, like with the projects that we're doing, is to kind of create that cognitive shift so that they see beyond the race and the usual categories they use, you know?
Yeah, well, I think that part of it is not just getting it puncture the brain, but puncturing the soul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Eastern concept on the Eastern, by what I mean is like Eastern Asia, you know, that you put
mm-hmm.
your hand right in the middle of your body.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where your soul is. That's where your heart is. Your heart's not in your chest. It's in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think that just like in Asian cultures that honors meditation, there's a
mm-hmm.
certain kind of social meditation that has to go on, which that's what you see when people gather in that church. That's the beginning
mm-hmm.
of it. It is a kind of thinking deeper at a different way. It is seeing somebody and saying, well, I'm here and they're here and we're all together in this. And being together in a movement produces
mm-hmm.
movement. It produces transformation. When people look out over the TV and they see us together, and it's black and white, it's young and old, it's Asian, that in itself begins to push folk to think more deeply, more moral, if you will, and not so isolated. So I think that's one thing. I think that I don't know if in
mm-hmm.
the analysis of America and social issues, if you will ever get totally beyond race. And what I mean by that is sometimes the depth of the moral wrongness
mm-hmm.
requires a disaggregation of the effect. In other words,
mm-hmm.
for instance, if you say that 9% of Americans unemployed, one way that you have to get at the depth of how wrong that is to define what 9% is in terms of real numbers. So 9% of 255 million. You have to say that's 25 million people. You see, and show the face. Then you have to say, But it's worse than that, what they're doing. You have 15% of minorities, or say 15% black, and then you have to say, and that represents so-and-so, so million people. If there are 40 million black people, then that represents, you know, 5.5. So sometimes it's just like when you go to court and you have a trial. You have to constantly put on evidence. And so in America, in order to get at the moral wrongness, the depth of the wrong, there requires sometimes a racial analysis, what we call disaggregation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how does this policy negatively affect women? How does it negatively affect minorities? How does it negatively affect African Americans? How does it negatively affect young people? But the third piece of getting past the race is then to be able to say, like Dr. King said, now that you know the depth of the wrong, understand that we're all inextricably bound. And and that's what Dr. King was trying to get people to see. That he said, you say, you can't keep me in the ditch unless you stay down here. For instance, we have to constantly remind people, North Carolina wouldn't have a Research Triangle Park if Jim Crow laws were still up. In other words, the coming down of the Jim Crow laws produced the New South, new investment, new businesses, you know, new possibilities that never could exist in racism. So that's the way we began to get people to think about right and wrong, is to show the depth of the problem, and sometimes to show the racial impact of the problem, but then to say, now all of us are inextricably bound by the effects of this policy. So all of us have got to fight it because it's moral. And then finally, fourth thing, in the South, the Bible Belt, progressives and liberals can't throw away faith. It's too powerful. I certainly not going to throw it away. What we have to do is recover and lift up authentic Christian articulation, as opposed to this kind of divided conservative, ultra-conservative Christianity or faith, which says the only moral issues are where you stand on abortion, where you stand on homosexuality, and where you stand on prayer in the school. And what I have found is that when I go places and lift up, did you know that there are more scriptures in the Bible about economic justice and how you treat the poor than any other text in the Bible? In fact, if you cut out all about the scriptures that deal with poverty, the Bible would literally fall apart. People say, what? I didn't know that. I said, oh, yeah. Did you know that the thing that Jesus talked about more than any other ethic was how you love the least of these? And how you, and he wasn't talking to individuals. He was talking to systems and governments. And so there is a real sense in which we need a revival in the South of prophetic social justice religion. That's what Dr. King was bringing about. King didn't take new faith, a new Bible, and start the civil rights movement in the South. He took basically Southern Baptist theology, you know, but he took it with the sharp edge of a prophetic social justice critique. And one of the reasons why he made, you know, some white ministers who were either wanting to go slow or white ministers who were committed to racism so mad is because he would put their own Bible in their face. And in the face of their people. So that's why you get, for instance, like you met Bob Zellner, who's with us, right? So Bob Zellner is with us, and Bob Zellner grew up in the Klan. You know, granddad was a Klan, daddy was a Klan. He met Dr. King and Rosa Parks. They showed him, his dad and all had told him that the Bible justified racism. He met Rosa Parks and Dr. King, and they said, no, 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 son, that's not real faith. And they showed him real faith. Bob was there and got out of his family and became the first white person to work for SNCC. See, that we have to have not just a probing of the mind, but a revival of the soul, I believe, in order to really get at this racial divide. And it's work, but I think we are closer than we've ever been. I look at my children and the world they're growing up in and the way in which they see things and the friends that they have over their house, you know. Real quickly, and I'll let you go. I was coming home one day, Eric, and I came in the house, and this little Asian boy was sitting at my table. And I said, I walked to the door. He was sitting at the table. He said, hey, Dr. Bob, how you doing? And he was working on my son's computer. So I said, okay, where's William? I said, where's my son? He said, oh, he's gone. I said, well, who's here with you? He said, nobody. I said, okay. So when my son came back home, I said, son, what's going on here? He said, what, Dad? I said, you left. He said, oh, yeah, that's my brother. I said, where did your mama have a little Asian boy? He said, Dad, you all don't get it. He said, we live in a different world. He said, he's working on my computer, and I'm helping him with a history project, and that's my brother. And I went in my room and thought, my God, we have some ways to go, but how far we have come. that I would have never done that as a child. You know, I would have never brought somebody in the house of a different culture and left them in my house. You know, I don't know if they would have come even if I offered it. And yet, my son felt comfortable enough to do it, and the young fellow felt comfortable enough to stay. And when he walked, when I walked through the door, there was no fear.
Mm-hmm.
I was afraid because I didn't know what was going on, because I still got some of that old in me, you know, that I struggle with. And we are, and you have to admit that. But in him, he and my son, there was no fear. And there's a scripture in the Bible that says, perfect love casts out all fear. And so the more we interact in movements, the more we come together, the more we cut across lines, the more we find common agendas to find on, the more we engage in fusion movement, the more we sit in churches like we did yesterday with people of all different colors and kinds and creeds, and we find a sense of purpose. It rooted in a deep moral, anti-racist, anti-poverty movement, that's where transformation will come.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us. I mean, I so appreciate every conversation I have with you and just listening to you at these events. But I do want to add to what you just said, that I would love to see, along with this, what you're calling revival of the soul, revival of democracy. And I think that has to somehow get connected together, those two things.
We need to engage in a false dichotomy, because we see right now what is going on, as you know, you heard me articulate it, when politicians are so abusive in their power that they will attempt in a short span of time, and I believe these folk in North Carolina are doing what they're doing because they know their time is limited. They know their narrow-minded agenda will not survive a full public scrutiny. But when they are so callous that they'll hurt the poor, they'll hurt children, I think that we are at a crisis of the soul. And I think the soul and the heart of our democracy is at stake. And so what I argue for is connecting the two together. And the reason I say that is because all of our founding documents that lay out who we are as a democracy start with this notion of the providence of God. And it starts with these moral underpinnings that ought to frame how we act, you know, whether it's the first United States Constitution. It's interesting to me, Annabelle and Eric, that our Constitution does not start with the goal of government being freedom. Now, you wouldn't think that, because every time politicians run for office, what do they say? I stand for freedom, freedom. They say freedom 1,000 times in a debate. But in the Constitution, before you can get to the passing on to your posterity the blessings of liberty, the Constitution says you must establish justice. You must promote the general welfare. You see what I'm saying? And the common good. Otherwise, what is freedom? It's chaos. It's being disconnected. It's being free to be disconnected and uncaring. And that's not the freedom that is defined in our document. You come to the North Carolina Constitution after the Civil War. Those people came together and they said, first, if we're going to exist under the providence of God, then we got to be committed to some fundamental principles: life, liberty, the enjoyment of the fruit of your own labor, and the pursuit of happiness. And each one of those premises, just like establishing justice, promoting the general welfare, all of those principles have deep moral centers in all of the major religious faiths. So I think the soul of our democracy is greatly dependent on the depth of our moral understandings and underpinnings. The two have to go together in a very powerful way.
Wow. Well, thank you. Eric, do you want to say something?
Well, Reverend Barber, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I think that our listeners definitely learned a lot. There are many of the people that you want to reach, not just for North Carolina's sake, but for our country's sake, to really connect the problem of money and politics to the problem of race. And there are things that can unite us. You mentioned faith, and I think that's a good one. Also, I think the economic growth of our country and of your state, North Carolina, William Chafee, the professor from Duke, who's in one of the videos we did along with you, was talking about the research triangle. We talked about that as well. But just basically economic growth, people's willingness to come here with their investment dollars, to come here to start new companies, or to come here to work and to bring their ideas and innovation. You need to have a stable economic, stable political, and stable social climate. So I think that you're doing something that's not just for the NAACP. It's not just for poor people. It really is for your state, and it's for your country as well, and I thank you for that.
Well, thank you, Eric, and I think you're right. In fact, the NAACP has never really done anything just for black people. It was founded primarily by whites. It was founded because people saw, you know, a reneging, a backing up from the promises of freedom and the promise of our Constitution. And we're one organization that, if you look at every legal victory we have won, it's been good for America. I mean, just take the Civil Rights Act of 1964. All of the provisions in there for disabled people and for women wouldn't be there if it hadn't been for that victory. The Voting Rights Act of 65. You know, if without that, white women couldn't serve on juries. And I could go down the line. And this movement today, when we fight, you know, I told a guy the other day, said he didn't like what we're doing. And I said, well, that's all right. But we love you enough to fight that even if you don't like it, if you have a family member that needs health care, they'll be able to get it. You know, when we fight to make sure 170,000 people get their unemployment, it doesn't matter to us if 10,000 of them are Republican or 80,000 of them are white. That's not the point. The point is the moral perspective of love and justice demand that we fight. And I believe, last thing, that love and justice still have great magnetic power to pull people together and to pull people in a space that the other minds may never have dreamed themselves of being in. I still believe that your enemy can actually be redeemed and become your friend if you're willing long enough to stand on principles that are higher than just right, just, you know, black and white, but the principle of love and justice and what is right versus what is wrong.
Wow. Well, I totally agree with you. I can't wait until Monday to see how many people turn up. I'm hoping.
Well, let's see. I'm excited about what God is doing and what's going to happen. Take care, and God bless.
Thank you. Thanks, Reverend Barber.
Okay, so we had a caller that called in from 620 area code, and I am afraid that person probably wanted to talk to Reverend Barber, but we're going to bring him on anyway in case they'll settle for me and Annabelle. 620 area code, tell us your name, where you're calling from, what's on your mind.
Hey, this is Jack Golding.
Hey, Jack.
And we're talking about unemployment insurance.
Well, you know, there was an interesting point that Reverend Barber brought up. He's a historian, and also he's a man of faith, and he's a civil rights leader here in North Carolina, where Annabelle and I are shooting our documentary. And he said that in order to pass the New Deal, and this is Jack from Kansas. Jack is a senior citizen. He has, he has firsthand experience from history, listeners. So I want to see how he responds to this. But do you recall that in order to get New Deal programs implemented, that they needed to exclude African Americans, otherwise there would not be support in Congress from Southern Democrats?
Okay, let me say something about myself. Okay, I went to Roosevelt University in Chicago, and I was a member of the first integrated fraternity in the history of fraternities called Beta Sigma Tau. I don't know if that's relevant to you, but we had all kinds of people, races, had black, we maybe had a white president and a black secretary or something, and Chinese maybe recording secretary. And okay, I'm really proud of that.
That is amazing.
Because you get
that
to meet all kinds, make all kinds of friends, regardless of race, regardless of ethnicity. because I don't like the term race too well.
You know, Reverend Barber had another thing that he said when we interviewed him. We never included that in any of the work that we've done so far, but it's a great phrase. What he said was is that, and he alluded to us, you know, in similar fashion, he alluded to it tonight, that when Jim Crow fell, when the walls of Jim Crow fell, it didn't just liberate black people, but it let the rest of the world in. It let the rest of the world into the South so that the South could grow economically and culturally. And what you reminded me of just now is that there are so many people I meet who are actually ethnically, they are Caucasian, but they don't identify just as Caucasian. In fact, part of what makes them, a large part of what makes them proud to be American is the diversity and richness and dynamism of our culture. And actually, they actually miss that when they find themselves in parts of the country that don't have that diversity, and they long to come back to parts of the country that do. And it sounds like that's something you experienced at an early age, Jack.
And, of course, working for the post office, having worked for the post office and for the federal government for some like 32, 33 years of my life, it's very well much integrated. And it's always about equal pay for equal, as far as gender goes, and never. And my father, even back in the 20s, he had had health benefits, had health insurance, had because he was he died of lung cancer, but. And he was pretty well treated, okay? And I want to see equal justice, but the Republicans, the way they are, most of them, they want to go back to the, before Teddy Roosevelt even.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. You know, it's the Republicans today, and it was the Democrats in the past who accepted this mantle. It's kind of like, you know, whenever the ruling class sees that actual investment in the people of this country would be something that would be counter to their profit margins. For instance, if they're no longer able to exploit slave labor, they'd be opposed to that. Or if they have to pay a minimum wage, they'd be opposed to that. Or if they're going to be taxed on Social Security taxes at the same level as the rest of us, instead of getting a special out once they've paid a minimum amount of money to Social Security. They're against that, of course. And so they basically, they float money, basically, and also I think you could say media empires. They float their money in the media empires and say, these things will help whoever will take our agenda. These things will help you win elections. Who will do it for us? Who will do it? And it was the Democrats for a long time, and it was the Republicans in the last 30 years or so, but along with saying, yes, I take that money and I'll take those media empires in order to, you know, back in the 1860s, we're talking about, you know, propaganda in newspapers that made people think that black men were going to come and rape your daughters and that they were lazy people that were just going to live off of your tax dollars and then they'll kill you to boot. Or what we're talking about, the propaganda that Newt Gingrich and Fox News will put out that our social programs only benefit black people, and if we take them away, we're sticking it to black people, and they deserve it because they're lazy, and they'll rape your daughters and all that stuff. I mean, that package that's offered to whichever political party will take the agenda of the ruling class, the profiteering class, and try to shove it down our throats, it comes with a price. And the price is that then you must exploit racial division. You must make your platform exploitation of racial division, because that's the only way that you can divide our populace enough to cause them to vote against their own interests. And as long as there were enough Southern whites, enough descendants of Southern whites, as long as there was enough of a white majority in this country, it was a pretty safe bet that if you can make the election about race, Willie Horton or the Civil Rights Movement or the riots of the late 60s, or welfare queens, or Barack Hussein Obama. If you can make the election about race, the bet was you can win. And it really doesn't matter that your policies are actually the policies of the economic elite, because there's going to be enough voters who actually believe, and I won't say gullible because, you know, I don't think that's a nice way to put it, but there are enough people who actually believe, trust that the media products, the advertising they receive, the political advertising they receive, often disguised as news, is accurate. And so, you know, that price is being paid now by the Republican Party more dearly than ever before, really, because now that white majority isn't large enough for that to win every time. Sometimes it loses. In fact, at the national level, it's probably bound to lose for many years until they live down 30 years of race-based electioneering. And I'm sorry, Jack, just one more thing I want to say about it. Reverend Barber wasn't quite ready to go there, but I said to him that, you know, in the same way that we have to deal with the trauma of having invaded the wrong country in response to the September 11th attacks and cost ourselves a couple $5 trillion and caused hundreds of thousands of people to lose their lives and displaced millions more, caused thousands of soldiers to die, thousands of families to be fractured, and put ourselves in this tremendous debt so that we can no longer be the country that we were just 13 years ago. That trauma, if we chose, we could blame it on the soldiers, right? We could say, those darn soldiers, they never should have gone to fight. They were so gullible, they shouldn't believe it. Or we could blame it on ourselves, those of us, including me, who were fooled by the propaganda, fooled by the media products that said, so Saddam Hussein has a nuclear weapon, it's going to be loaded onto some sort of floating device, and it's going to hit us in New York City. We got to attack. Okay, or we could just, you know, take Lincoln's advice and say, let's be charitable to all, let's have malice toward none. And some of us, yes, some of us were fooled, and some of us went to war, and some of us supported the war. I just wonder if the fusion politics, if this multiracial alliance that Reverend Barber's wanted to build, if we would make some strides in building it, if we could say, you know what, not everyone who fought on the Confederate side of the Civil War was an evil racist. And maybe you could even say not everyone who was cautious or conservative or trepidatious or afraid of the civil rights movement is and was a racist. And maybe we can have malice toward none and charity for all and say we're all one country now, and we got in the right direction. Some of us who believed in the Iraq War have changed our minds. Many people who are against the civil rights movement have changed their minds. And I think if instead of pointing at people and saying, you are an idiot for supporting that, or your ancestors were racists for supporting that, instead of saying that, if we found another way to reach them, and Reverend Barber is working on doing so through faith and through economic interests, that maybe we could become all one country. It doesn't have to root against the success of our own country just because we don't like the outcome of an election. What do you think about that, Jack?
Yeah. Oh, let me say this. Can you say this?
Go ahead.
Are you on? Yeah. Okay. As far as the Iraq war goes, I was for it. Because being Jewish, you know, Hussein was probably the one of the biggest Jew haters in the world. And he had to have his comeuppance. And why we chose Saddam Hussein over Iran, and it turns out that Iran and Iraq are getting buddy-buddy, as you can see. And we didn't gain anything from the Iraq war. In fact, I don't know if it's our fault or what it is, but Iraq is pushing close to Iran.
Mm-hmm.
As philosophy goes.
Yeah. There were all kinds of just horrifically tragic consequences from that war, and a lot of people didn't foresee it. And we're still healing from that today, but I think perhaps not to the degree that we're healing from the Civil War. And that's, you know, that's the subject of Story of America. That's a new film Annabelle and I are making. Jack, thank you so much for your call. Storyofamerica.org is where you can see early clips that we're releasing as the movie is being made. You can go to 404 area code. I think I know who this is. Bobby, is that you?
Yes. Hi. Good evening, Eric and Annabelle and Jack and everybody else. How's everybody this evening? Marvelous show.
We're We're doing great. Great to hear from you, Robert Rodrigo from Atlanta. What did you think of the show and Reverend Barber's approach to social change?
Yeah, I have been following what you've been doing in North Carolina, as you know, since you mentioned it and when you were in Wilmington and when you first interviewed him about the Reconstruction and the fusion politics that you discussed earlier. And then I know that I had sent you some things to try and help you with some artwork, some photos for the piece that you did. And it certainly was eye-opening. There was much that I did not either remember, or realize, or know at all. And I appreciate what he's doing, and his approach is excellent, and your coverage of it is excellent. And North Carolina is certainly as much of a hotbed in this country right now as anywhere, considering both the political agenda of the ruling party and the response by the North Carolinians, as Reverend Barb would put it, certainly a lesson in civil discourse and civil disobedience at its finest. Certainly a lot of the people that were involved understand how to do it, considering the history that they talk about. I did have a chance to watch your videos both before. I actually watched it again today, earlier when you made the announcement and you posted it. I didn't chime in earlier, but I should have. I didn't realize he wasn't going to be on. I wanted to give you guys a chance to let him talk. But one of the questions I had is, some years ago I had saw a gentleman on one of the afternoon shows. It was either Donahue or Oprah, because I've never really watched anybody else. And it was probably Donahue, but I saw a military man come on the show, and he had a message for our society that has stayed with me the entire time. And since our economy has become so unequal, and since money and politics has gotten so crazy, I've kind of tracked it, because when you mentioned the divisions earlier that are in our society, I think that has something to do with it. When Annabelle was talking to Reverend, she mentioned, you know, that she was a Southern and Asian American, and it reminded me of this particular thing, and I'll tell you what I mean. I'll just make it a question. One of the questions I have for you guys, for Reverend Barber, for our coffee party, and for our society is, don't you think that one of the reasons why we are divided is that this country has yet to become old enough to drop anything but ourselves being American when we're born here? Or when we're citizens, you know, obviously we all are from somewhere else at some point in our history. But when does this country become old enough to just be an American? Years ago, I heard the example I always use when I have this discussion, especially because it first became prominent, as it is now with the African Americans, and of course their plight was somewhat different than everybody else's, but. With
hey, Robert, let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question real quick.
Mm-hmm.
What's your ethnic background?
I am Puerto Rican and Sicilian.
Okay, thanks. Sorry, continue. I just wanted to. Mm-hmm. I never asked you that before, but now that you're saying, mm-hmm. By the way, a lot of the guys, these Confederate reenactors that we talked to down in Alabama. They mm-hmm. said the same thing. They said what we really need is for people to stop calling themselves African American and Asian American. And it was funny because there was four or five different interviews, and they all tried to get Annabelle and I to agree to stop calling ourselves Asian American. And it was, they didn't hear each other, say it. It was just one after another. They brought it up independently. So it's something that conservatives are thinking about a lot as well. So go ahead with that, Robert.
Yeah, I always tell people, I said, Lennox Lewis, who was born in Great Britain, is not an African Englishman or African Great Britain, or somebody of English descent who was born in France is not an English French person. And it goes all around the world. We are the only country that does that from the standpoint of ethnicity, at least with as many cultures. There's certainly little pockets here and there. And there are divisions of religion, per se, but not like what we do, Italian-American, Irish-American, Greek-American, Black-American, African-American, and so Asian-American, and so on. And one of my pet peeves is our documentation, both from the standpoint of private and from polling and from in our government, wants to know what quote unquote race you are on anything that you're involved with. And of course, you can now refuse to answer it. There was a time where they didn't even have that offered. But what's the point of all of that anymore? Understanding, I'm not trying to take away, when I ask this question, I'm not trying to take away from any kind of safety net issues and or anything like that. It's strictly a matter of country identity and removing division. You know, and we're all participating in Annabelle's wonderful subject about the divisiveness in America. And this is something, again, I've been thinking about this for a long time. I do not remember that gentleman's name who said it. I have to go back and look. I'm sure with our internet, I can find it. I've never needed to, in the sense of I once he said it, I totally got it. I mean, it totally makes sense. Let's all just be Americans, and then discuss the inequality of wealth and entitlement, unemployment, because then it's not based upon anything else other than the fact that we're Americans, and it's these Americans have a problem, we need to fix it, not these African Americans or these poor Americans. You know, we are so title driven anyway, and then to have that aspect of it. I don't get it anymore, and I think that might be a way to help us.
Well, that's a really great observation. It clicked for me when you said that if we could remove those ethnic sort of factions, that these questions about lifting our country up by having a strong middle class, by lifting people out of poverty, well, we wouldn't second guess that, right? Because we wouldn't be thinking about, well, we don't want to help those people. We want to educate those people's children. So it's a great point. I'm going to let Annabelle respond. Go ahead, Annabelle.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is an interesting point, and in a sense, we have been talking to people with that same point. I have put a lot of thought into it, and I think there's a lot of validity to it. I mean, I guess the reason why I'm hesitant in kind of just accepting that point of view is I don't think the idea is to try to make us homogeneous. You know, I think America is really about being accepting of the fact that we are different and we're diverse. And I feel like we should be going towards celebrating diversity instead of trying to say we're the same. And I think that's a different psychology. I think equality is a different matter. You know, we can have equal rights without being the same. And I feel like if we were to just dispense with the idea of, you know, calling ourselves American, then somehow we're somehow thinking there's something wrong with being heterogeneous society, pluralistic society. And I think it's an important concept and principle for America that we are a pluralistic democracy in which we can celebrate our heritage and we can celebrate our identities in different ways.
I agree with you 100%, Annabelle. And everything you just said. I certainly don't want to take away from the equal rights issue because that is so prominent. But if you recall, 25 years ago or so. I mean, I guess part of my feelings about this is the fact that I grew up in the most diverse city in the world and in the most diverse neighborhood in that city in the world, actually, at the time when I grew up in Astoria, Queens. And so we didn't go around with that when we were children. None of us did, per se, you know, to some degree. It was a fact in our lives, in our families. You know, we had our food and we had our culture, and if you wanted to be around the other culture, all you had to do was go to that deli or that bakery. So it is a little different in New York and cities like that than it is elsewhere. So maybe I'm a little more used to it. Your points are absolutely valid. I just didn't grow up having a need to say it as part of some kind of politic or paperwork or. It just seems like it's being used now to keep us divided as opposed to the reasons that you're talking about. And the reason that you're talking about when I grew up and my reason to feel that way is because it was never necessary to have I'm a Puerto Rican American or a Sicilian American or whatever, I'm just an American. And when you say, well, what's your cultural background? I said, you know, my great-great-great-grandfather owned the barn where John Wilkes Booth was caught. That's a fact. Now, so I certainly have enough American heritage, but, you know, so what? I just want to be a person treated equal as everybody else does. And if somebody says, well, what's your culture? I says, well, come in over and I'll cook some Latin food for you, or I'll cook some wonderful pasta for you, and you'll know. That's how, you know, it certainly has to do with where I grew up, but that's kind of where my thought is. But your points are equally, I mean, very important, even more so than what I'm saying, in the sense that you've got to remember equal rights and stuff like that.
Right. I mean, you know, the reality is that, you know, we're still kind of, the reason why race is relevant, I mean, I think it's important to think critically about when race is considered relevant by the government, you know, on forms and things like that. I think it's good to question the relevance of identifying yourself by race in some official capacity. But to me personally, race is still relevant because we're in still a transitional period when we're striving for equal rights and striving for civil liberty, civil rights, and that, you know, in order for us to get to more perfect union, you know, we have to be able to be very open about the history of injustice, and you know, I think it is relevant, and I don't think we can make progress by being in denial about history.
You know, Robert, I'm going to give you a chance to respond, but I was dying to hear Annabelle say something like that, and I'm not smart enough to have known what it was going to be, but she didn't respond to any of these Confederate-dressed grown men, dressed as Confederate soldiers, whom I think going in, Annabelle and I thought were going to be crazier than they were. They weren't that crazy. Definitely very conservative, very much Fox News consumers, but one of the things that they asked of us, I think the most important thing was, don't call my ancestors a traitor or a racist. And the second most important thing to them was, stop calling yourself Asian Americans. Will you please agree not to be an Asian American? Please, please, don't think of yourself as an Asian American, and then everything will be better in our country. And I think that it would have been interesting to have Annabelle give them that response. And I just thought of what I should have said. You know, usually I'm behind the camera, but I sometimes chime in. And that is, you know, Annabelle's sitting right in front of you, okay? Take a look at her, okay? And imagine that she agreed. Okay, I'm no longer going to call myself Korean-American. I won't call myself Asian-American ever again. Do you think that you and the other people out on the battlefield right now and the other people who watch Fox News every day are going to then look at Annabelle and not see an Asian face? Because I don't know I don't know if we're quite there yet. So anyway, Robert, what do you think?
You know, I don't want to trivialize, you know, what Annabelle was saying, but the way I feel about it is that in order to have equal rights in this country, all you have to be is born. You know, that I am not I believe, and as silly as it might sound, I believe there is only one race, and that's the human race. I don't even like the word. The only reason why I tolerate the word race is because of its proper use is to point out racism. Unfortunately, you know, it is the definition of what we're talking about, so I have to tolerate it, you know, just to have a conversation about it. But I prefer, you know, ethnic culture, et cetera. I understand totally where all of that is coming from, but to me, equal rights is the problem with equal rights is that people don't look upon other people as people. That without question. So, again, your points are completely reality. You know, I have to be pragmatic about all this anyway. You know, so part of this is a hope thing, but from the standpoint of being divisive and trying to solve that in order to get something done that is true and real and accomplish it real, not some glossed over way, you know, by saying, okay, now we're all Americans, so it's fixed. You know, we certainly have to look at each other differently, and maybe one way of doing that is to just, in fact, we have to, with the immigration thing too. That's another thing that's and as you guys have pointed out so much, immigration is the immigration issue and the people that are here that are involved in it directly are tied right into our society. And if we I had to turn off my Bluetooth. If we would just look at each other as people, we would have a different view of that. We've been doing this with Cain and Abel, as I say, on other issues. There's certain people have to be better, think they're better, conquer, steal, take, be control. We have all those flaws that are going on. But from our country's standpoint, we are doing something different, both as being based upon freedom, as well as keeping ourselves divided, not so much how we feel about ourselves, but how it is being talked about in our communities and politically. You just can't have the only time we ever talk about the good or about being united is when there's a tragedy and you see how people respond against it together. Otherwise, it isn't existing in our everyday life because everybody's divided.
I think, like I said, I think being different from one another, having diversity that's not necessarily divided. Me thinking I'm Asian American, to me, isn't divided. It depends on how people respond to it, but I don't think it's divided to say I'm Asian American or I'm a Southerner. I like saying I'm a Southerner, and I'm proud of the fact that I grew up in the South, And there will be always ways in which we describe each other. if not Asian, maybe our people would just see me as being a short American. I mean, there are always going to be ways we distinguish each other. But I guess that point is really about accepting and tolerance and not so much, just feeling like we have to control the categories that people use to describe themselves. Like, I don't think that helps us to, be closer to one another. I think what will bring us closer to each other is to understand that our country is pluralistic, it's diverse, it's premised on the idea that we can coexist and govern together despite our differences, and we can thrive on our differences instead of being afraid of our differences.
Well, thank you, Annabelle. We're going to have to let Annabelle go. She's got to call and check on her dog, her lovely dog, Dudley, who we hear isn't doing so well back home. Robert, before we close the show out, I just wanted to ask if there are any other things that you heard from Reverend Barber tonight that you wanted to respond to.
Yeah, his assessment of the economics that you guys highlighted on is dead on. It's so obvious that this is about the poor as much as it is about everything, about anything, and how, when he was talking about the Koch brothers and their history, and how he was talking about how the money draws people to have an agenda, the way he discussed about, okay, I want you to have this agenda. We're going to put you in the office, and this is how you have to pay us back, is essentially how I took it. It's dead on, and of course it goes right down the highway of money and politics, and how it is all tied together. I mean, it's very interesting listening to the way you guys were tying all that together, because it is the trail that is of what's going on. The elections are tied to the money. The agriculture now is just tied to money. Everything is just following that path. And it is in the fact that it's consistently being battled by him the way he is just wonderful. And I hope that other people are inspired by it.
To me, the education that I received, 908 area code, we're going to bring you on in a second, but the education, and thank you, Robert, for calling, the education that I received, I studied, two-thirds of my classes were film studies when I went to college, and I never went higher than an undergraduate degree, but I have learned so much traveling around the country and talking to people, listening to people, and yes, that historical context, to understand that really the history of racism and white supremacy, Jim Crow, Ku Klux Klan, and all those things, I just thought it was because people were hateful. But in many ways, people, you know, I guess the next more charitable word is they were gullible. They didn't actually know a lot of African Americans, but what they read in the paper or what they heard politicians saying to them about what desegregating their schools might do scared them. And I think that if we understand that, you know, Reverend Barber said there was an economic center to slavery and that there were people who needed slavery in order to maximize their profits. I mean, isn't it great you get people to work, they aren't paid anything, and then when they have children, you own them too and you can exploit them as well. I mean, it was a great economic system for them, and really when we went to war, it wasn't those wealthy planters. It was the poor whites who fought, and they actually themselves didn't actually own slaves. 908 area code, you're on the middle ground. You're going to be our last caller. Let us know your name, where you're calling from, what's on your mind.
Hello, this is Chad calling from New Jersey.
Hey, Chad.
Hey, how you doing? Just something I wanted to mention real quick before we close up. When Robert brought up that thing about, you know, what is an American and things like that, quickly I went on the internet and just did a quick question for the internet, what is an American? And I came across this fascinating paragraph that apparently was published Monday, May 10th, 1948 in Time magazine. And I'll just read you this paragraph. It's really interesting. And I think personally this is defining what Americans are and why it's so messy. Let me read you this. It says, 2,000 years ago, when Western civilization was bounded by laws and legions of the Roman Empire, the proudest words a man could utter were, "I am a citizen of Rome." A century ago, when the world was girdled by the British Empire, the Englishman's voice sounded from the earth's far corners, "I am a British subject." Now, in the middle of the 20th century, the most arresting tones of history said something else, "I am an American." What did the phrase mean? The U.S. citizen would vociferously deny that he was the subject of any government, even in name. That's phenomenal, because that's why it's so messy in America. For all our pride in America, we're also incredibly individualistic and deny almost any sort of pigeonholing of anything about us. And I think that's why there's so much anger with each other in groups and things like that, just because we don't want to be pigeonholed. And so some people say, my father used to say, I don't want to agree with anybody. I want my opinion to be my opinion. And I think this phrase is just perfect for why we have these problems. Not problems, it's what makes us so unusual than other countries in the world. That's my only comment.
You know, if those the Confederate reenactor guys, you know, if I could have asked them one request, right? Their one request is that Annabelle and I not refer to ourselves as Asian American anymore. I think my request would be, when you say the word American, please do not try to imply that for some reason you are more American than Annabelle and I are, that you are more American than a person of color, or that you are more American than a non-Christian, or even more American than someone whose ancestors weren't here when we declared independence or when we fought the Civil War. A person who is an American citizen is equal under the law. They're every bit as American as everyone else. And the one thing I think that bothers me the most about that whole culture that is really the focus, I think, in our country, whether it's economic issues, money and politics, whether it's immigration, even climate science. So the one thing that's holding us back is this culture that thinks they're more American than everyone else. So they dress up in these costumes, or we're running out of time. But that's right. That's the one thing I would have asked of them. What do you think, Chad?
I sort of agree with that, but I think that's the difficulty of America, is that the diversity. And I, quite frankly, when you think see what's going on in the world, like in Syria and things like that, and the violence that's happening, we are damn lucky that we don't have that. Even the civil rights movement, which was horrific back in the 60s and stuff like that, it never broke into the kind of violence that is happening around the world for what people want for whatever reason, but a clip that came out just yesterday about the rebels in Syria, cutting out the soldier's heart and eating it. It's just like, what? So we don't know who to support, things like that. But in America, somehow, for all our differences and for all the inequality that we seem to espouse, we, at the same time, we haven't let it taken us to the extremes that the rest of the world is seems to be going through. Not to say that we shouldn't fight for what's right, but, you know, or what we think is right. But anyway, it's a good show. Good show.
Thank you, Todd. Okay, well, we're going to close out now. I'm going to give Annabelle a chance to give her closing thoughts.
Okay.
Annabelle, you're back. What's the update? How's Dudley doing?
He's doing better. I mean, what I wanted to close out by saying is that I really think in order for us to make better progress as a country, in every sense of the word, you know, we really need to be more respectful of each other and our differences and be able to listen to each other without putting making too many assumptions. And right now, I feel like, you know, it's the norm to think that we know about people when we've never actually had a conversation with them. And it's a personal thing, but I feel like it has political implications that we get past our own mythologies because we all have them. We all have them. Whether or not you're just denigrating people who watch Fox News or not, we all have our own mythologies. And it's important that we approach everyone with more respect and higher tolerance and perspective of that person as an individual. So that's a, you know, one lesson for me so far in Story of America. And I'm sure there'll be many, you know, permutations of this, but you know, I do have faith that we are we the people and that we can get past our differences in order to make progress. So thanks, everyone, and I'll check in with you guys later.
Okay. So I have to play this thing that's for the end of the middle ground. Michael Charney always does it, but I'm going to do it this time. You've been listening to Coffee Party Radio. The Middle Ground is brought to you usually by Michael Charney, but he's going to be taking a little break. You'll hear from Michael here and there, but I'm going to be kind of hosting the show with different co-hosts. I might have to tap Annabelle again in the future. Our website is coffeepartyusa.com. You can listen to Dan Aronson on Monday nights. Janine Loudon and Debbie Lynn Molyneux, they do Lunch with Loudon Thursdays at 3 o'clock Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific. Egberto Willis is on with Politics Done Right, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And then Tuesday nights, 8 o'clock, The Middle Ground. Tune in next week. We don't know what we'll be doing. We don't even know what city we'll be in. But hope to hear from you next week on The Middle Ground.
That's our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow The Middle Ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on The Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong, and be heard.